What do you see? The sun is rising, most definitely. A new day's coming. Ooh-hoo. People are changing.
Episode 4051, Leaning Toward Wisdom, the podcast. Why my business model is intentionally bad, and it's good for me.
And that's all right. So don't you give up now. So easy to find. Just look to yourself. Open your mind.
Welcome inside the Yellow Studio. My name is Randy Kentro, your host here at Leaning Toward Wisdom, the podcast. Find the show notes for today's episode at leaningtowardwisdom.com. Plug in the number 4051 in the search this website box and take you right there. Lots of links. And I'm increasingly hearing from people that, who'd have thunk it, you know, a podcaster and people read the blog post. I do. I have people, they email me. They don't listen, but they read the blog post. I go figure, to each his own. You are listening to Tommy James and the Shondells, a 1969 record. It was a hit. I bought it as a 45 when I was, how old was I? 12 years old. Crystal Blue Persuasion. And of course, at the outset, you know that theme music from Breaking Bad. This song appeared on the 8th episode of Season 5. Yeah, it did. Tommy James and the Shondells. I was a fan. I was a big fan of Tommy James and the Shondells. And at this point in my life, yes, I was buying 45s. They were about 75 cents, I'm thinking. 60 to 75 cents a piece. You know, and you bought it for the hit record that was on one side, and then on side B, you just kind of hoped it would be something good. I don't remember what was on side B of this particular record, but Tommy James and the Shondells. There's quite a few songs that I remember buying from them. Walter White never read, I don't think he ever read a book about business models. Now, Jesse Pinkman, he probably never read a book of any kind. I could be wrong about that. Doesn't matter, really, because they stumbled their way into a profitable, albeit criminal, business model. The other day I spent the better part of a day in front of the computer. I was doing some website work. I was doing some other computer-related mundane tasks, and thankfully there was a Breaking Bad marathon on AMC. Now, I watched the series when it first went around. But this time I was watching with today's topic being on the top of my mind because I've been having a lot of conversations lately with people about their business models. Tons of online articles have talked about the business lessons to be learned from Breaking Bad. I had to Google it because I don't know. Like I said, I was preoccupied with business models and here's Breaking Bad. It's on television. I'm experienced in figuring out good business models, even if my own business model sucks. Now, Walter White, he figured out something that he liked, something that he was good at. In fact, something that something that he said made him alive. I mean, too bad it was, too bad it was criminal. Too bad it involved drugs and lies and deceit and murder.
Skyler. All the things that I did. You need to understand.
I have to hear one more time that you did this for the family.
I did it for me. I liked it. I was good at it.
This, you may recall, was the final scene where Walter and Skyler meet in her little drab apartment. Yeah, it's not the answer she was expecting. She was expecting him to be true to everything else that he had done in life, to say he had done it for the family, trying to be honorable. The business model, it was pretty straightforward, and it was wildly successful. Create a unique and quality product, in this case, crystal meth, that had terrific quality, high purity, a blue tint, build distribution, be ruthlessly competitive. Product, process, and people. It's those magical three ingredients to every successful enterprise. People probably think I need this book, Business Models for Dummies. And this fellow whose last name I don't pretend to be able to pronounce, Mulehausen, Jim Mulehausen. In addition to running a company called CEO Focus, and I don't know him personally, but he operates Business Model Institute. It's intriguing. Now, I can be a dummy as much as the next guy when it comes to my own life, my own business. Maybe you can too. The weird thing is I have long been intrigued by business models. I've studied business models. And I have implemented more than my fair share. Here in North Central Texas, one of the most legendary stories of crafting a business model involves Roland King, Herb Kelleher, and Southwest Airlines. Kelleher, he was Mr. King's attorney, and they sat down at lunch one day in a San Antonio restaurant. And as the story goes, they drew the business model for Southwest Airlines on the back of a cocktail napkin. And, of course, if you know anything about Herb Kelleher, heavy emphasis on cocktail. Drawing out a business model is really ideal. And I think anybody that has done much business modeling will tell you it's good to diagram it out because sometimes words don't quite do the job. In fact, that's why Dan Rome wrote the book, Blah, 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 What to Do When Words Don't Work. Now, Dan is mostly famous for that book, The Back of the Napkin. Well, Herb Kelleher, he wasn't an artist, but it didn't matter because neither was Roland King. But they both knew, evidently, how to sketch out this idea, a business model that would revolutionize air travel. And the year was 1967, 2 years before Tommy James and the Shondells released Crystal Blue Persuasion. Okay, now get ready for a bombshell. According to Mr. King, it never happened. There was no drawing on the back of a napkin. He said that when he told Kelleher his idea for this kind of a regional airline, Herb scoffed at it, thought it was a terrible idea. And at some point, they moved forward anyway, and they executed this new business plan, this new business model, focused on a triangle route that would link San Antonio, Houston, and Dallas. Okay, napkin or not, they had a business model that worked well. And as they say, the rest is history. That may be the most famous business model construction here in Texas. I don't know. You know, Dell Computer, Michael Dell might have something to say about that. But Jeff Bezos, he constructed a pretty good one too. Eric Schmidt, he did too when he got to Google. There are lots more. But those, yeah, these are enormous enterprises. I mean, Southwest Airlines, Google, Amazon. What about those of us that are operating at a much smaller level? Can we learn how to craft a better business model for our organization, for our career, by looking at the big guys? I'm so selfish that I've developed the habit of reading books and examining big business, trying to apply what I can to my situation. Over at my other podcast, Higher Human Performance, I even recorded 4 episodes over there devoted to 4 books, business books, that really kind of helped shape me. Episodes 250, 251, 252, and 253. And yes, there are links to these over at the show notes, leaningtowardwisdom.com. Just go to episode 40, 51. And if you're not into business, don't worry about it because, you know, this stuff impacts us as working guys and gals too. The business brainiacs of the world, they tend to fly at altitudes that are so much higher than where we mere mortals operate. I mean, they just seem to breathe this rarefied air that I don't know about you, but my lungs can't handle it. And it's easy to dismiss big business as, you know, that's completely irrelevant to my circumstance. But I think that'd be shameful. I think it'd be shameful because they do have things that they can teach us if we'll just learn it. Now, granted, you're going to have to give it some thought. I mean, sometimes it does require strenuous thought to apply seemingly unobvious things to our situation, to our lives. And that's the point. Well, that's one of the points. The process of making application can help us distill ideas that will help us. And I think this is true not only just in business plans, business models, which, by the way, are different. I'll talk about that in a second. But in any area of life, to try to make application that can help us. Well, it's what we do here. It's a large part of what I do here at leaningtowardwisdom.com is trying to make application. And, of course, yes, I use music and popular culture and, well, just anything I can. The wrong thing to do is to copy or think that we can just use these stories or these things, these books, these whatever, these notions as a formula for our lives, as a formula for our work. That's lazy. And that's naive. Planning a good business model generates some creativity that can help us figure out a better way to do things. I didn't say a good business model does that, but planning a good business model does that. There's a book that I'm really fond of called Business Model U. It is subtitled A One-Page Method for Reinventing Your Career. It was produced by some very smart people who take a different look at architecting careers. In fact, the subtitle tagline at their website pretty much says it all. Workplace breakthroughs for individuals and enterprises. Well, hey, that fits us. We're individuals. We either are part of an enterprise as an employee or we're part of an enterprise as something else. There are lots of books about business model creation. And I think it proves that it's evidently top of mind with many people. It's evidently a popular topic with many people. Some people confuse a business plan with a business model. Yeah, they're not the same thing. You know, a business plan is more or less a sales document that people will use to sell other people on their enterprise. In fact, mostly we build a business plan so that we can get some investors to bet on us. I hate business plans, even though I have written more than my fair share of them. In fact, the last business plan that I wrote, it garnered lots of positive attention. In fact, I was told by a number of pretty highbrow people, this is the best business plan I've ever read. I was trying to buy the company that I was running. Okay, it didn't work out. But it was a great business plan. And no doubt it was made better because I had almost 20 years experience running the company. I mean, it wasn't a startup. Most business plans, though, they're not like that. Most business plans, they're wishful thinking. You know, we do these pro formas. A pro forma is just simply kind of this outlook for the next year, the next 3 years, the next 5 years, whatever. It's prediction. Well, okay. It's really not. It's wishful thinking more often than not, especially if it's a startup. Okay, that's not a business model. That's a business plan. According to the Houston Chronicle, quote, a business model is the narrative of how your business works. Simply put, it describes whom you sell to and how you make a profit. Each new venture will rely on a specific business model to take new products and services to a market. In that article, which is entitled, What is the Purpose of a Business Model?, author Dana Griffin writes, your model answers two questions. Who is your customer? And how do you create revenue? Your customer must be someone who needs your product or service. Be specific. The more closely you define your customer and his reasons for purchasing, the better. Keep your model simple. Avoid business language and describe it in 10 words or less. Most business models have already been invented, so it's advisable to relate yours to one with proven success. I completely agree. Who is your customer? I'd love to tell you that most everybody has got that figured out, but I can tell you in a lot of the work that I do, particularly the executive coaching that I do, people in a workplace, even leaders in a workplace, really struggle. They really struggle with figuring out who is your customer. Internal customers, external customers. You'd think it'd be easy. You'd think a no-brainer even, but it can be a real struggle for some people. In business, it's a struggle because people don't want to narrow it down. In organizations and enterprises and leadership inside a company, it can be a struggle because people don't think of, for instance, their boss being a customer. And when you look at a business, particularly a startup that's trying to figure it out, it just seems restrictive to say that you really want to sell to some people, but you don't want to sell to others. And these are the people that give us, you know, that patent answer. Who's your customer? Everybody. Who do you want to sell to? I want to sell to everybody. Experienced business people know that that's a terrible answer. It's an awful answer. My business model isn't terrible because of who I want to serve. Well, not entirely. Bula Network LLC is my company. It's a boutique executive coaching and consulting business. I'm a one-man band. That's intentional. For years, I operated small businesses that range from, let's call it $14 to $20 million, with lots of employees, lots of assets, inventory, physical facilities and stuff. I just no longer wanted to do that, so I don't. Now, I started out serving mostly as a roll-up-your-sleeves-and-get-your-hands-dirty consultant. And it was about doing the work. It was about doing the work while teaching other people how to better do the work. But mostly it was about serious problem solving. It was less about coaching. It was really more about consulting. But it wasn't that fabled consulting where, you know, the consultant comes in, he asks the business owner to borrow his watch, and then he tells the business owner what time it is, and then he leaves wearing the watch. Have you never heard that? No, I was busy diving into specific issues like pricing and lead generation and sales processes and employee retention. And I was even busy rewriting workflow documentation and RFPs and quotes for clients and until that work just grew too tiresome and too frustrating. Yeah, I'll tell you why. I'm fanatical about customer experience and customer service. And over time, I found myself having to face the reality that while I was improving processes and sometimes people, I couldn't control how committed the enterprise was to pleasing customers. You know, because some people, they just weren't as fanatical as I am. The people that were fanatical, like me, well, those relationships worked out well. That work worked out well. But other people, they just gave it lip service. They didn't follow through to make sure customers were happy. Those did not go so well. And still some others, well, they proved that they just didn't care if the customer was happy or not. And, of course, those went south. Those were terrible. And so a couple of years ago, I made up my mind that if I couldn't connect with like-minded people who would do whatever it took to make a customer happy, then I was just not going to do business with them. And I wish I could tell you that most business owners are very focused on serving their customers and their employees. But unfortunately, when you get behind closed doors and when you dig deep into an enterprise and you see them as they really are, not that front facade, that front of the store, but you get to the back of the store, you can quickly see that there's a disconnect way too often between what's said and what's done. And over the last few years, I have morphed into a more of an executive coach, helping leaders find a better way to serve their own careers by serving their employees and their customers. And that sometimes means their boss. And the operative word here, it's always the same verb, serve. And I'm drawn to it mostly because it runs deep. It's powerful because it's individual, it's instructional, it's exploratory, it's thoughtful, it's one-on-one. And I've seen the difference that it can make in a person's career and in their effectiveness to lead and to manage. And so the rewards, they're visible, they're tangible, and hopefully they last a long time. Hopefully people remember these things that we learn together. How do you create revenue? Here's the problem I have, and maybe you've got it too. I do not work to embed myself with somebody forever. I'm not trying to get people hooked on me. I begin all my work with the drive to put myself out of work. I want to help people grow, and I'm doing everything I can to help them develop greater strength to be more effective and more efficient in their work. And so my goal is to help them find a place where they don't need me anymore. Their success means an end of the road for me. It's not just a nobility thing. I'm not trying to be an overly nice guy, although I do want to be a nice guy. And I'm not doing it to be altruistic. I'm doing it because it's what I believe. I'm doing it because it's who I am. I'm doing it because it's how I roll and because it's how I want to roll. It's about finding out who you are, who you most want to be, and where you are determined to be. Back in episode 4040, go listen to episode 4040 if you haven't listened to it already. I did a show about how success may most often be determined by who wants it the most. Who wants to be there the most? You know, all these obstacles that get in our way, and guess what? They get in everybody's way. They tend to be nature's way of just weeding out the people who aren't willing to pay the price to be there. Figuring out who and what you are and where you most want to be, in my experience, that can just be really, really tough work. Being congruent with yourself, that's important, especially when it comes to crafting your business model. And like I said, this business model can just be your career. You don't have to be in business for yourself. It's more true when you're a service professional like me. But you know, when I was running bigger enterprises, it was still important. How you lead, how you manage, how you interact with others, it's determined by who you really are and who you most want to be, based on your natural abilities, based on your inclinations. I mean, look at Gary Vaynerchuk. Now, I don't care if you love him or not. He's being who he is. He is not living some fake version of himself. It seems to me that he's very congruent. And that's what you want to be when you construct your business model. And that's how you want to behave inside your business model too. Now, I'm not nearly as high strung as Gary V. I couldn't operate like he does for all the tea in China. There is no way, no how. I'd likely need to enroll in a decade of acting classes, and it would be an act. Okay, but with Gary V, it's not an act. And he could no more behave like I do if his life hinged on it. We are completely different personalities, and we come from completely different backgrounds with very different worldviews. Now, I agree an awful lot with what Gary says and what he writes, but I hate the industry where he and his father worked, the liquor business. I oppose it religiously. I oppose it morally. But I respect Gary's business perspectives. I respect his hustle. I respect his digital agency work. I respect his marketing acumen. He's a business rock star. I mean, there is no doubt. And he's experiencing wild success because he's smart, he's hungry, he's full of hustle, he's full of real-world advice, and he's got this larger-than-life personality. How many people have you met personally who have that kind of a personality? None. Yeah, exactly my point. You know, Gary is Gary, and he's comfortable being Gary. And it would be a big mistake for others, like me, to copy his business model or to copy him. His business model is built on him. Now, meanwhile, over at Amazon, Jeff Bezos and, well, Zappos, Tony Hsieh, they have respectively built Amazon and Zappos. Now, those companies have their fingerprints all over them. In fact, Zappos sold some years ago to Amazon. But, you know, their business models are much less dependent on them personally. Now, I suspect Gary Vee, he likes the way he built it. But check that. Even though I don't know him personally, I guarantee he has built VaynerMedia, his digital agency, exactly the way that it best fits him. It happens that his business model is pretty terrific, and it enables him to scale into this really large enterprise. Now, this is where my own congruency works against me. Let me use my wife to explain and illustrate this. She operates a website at Doll Dresses by Rhonda. It's also rhondacantrell.com. Now, she loves to sew. In fact, I put a photograph over in the show notes of one of the dresses that is posted over at her website. LeaningTowardWisdom.com, episode 4051. And you can see a photograph there in the show notes, or the blog post, as we say. She loves to sew. Some years ago, before we had a granddaughter, she discovered lifelike dolls made by a lady named Annette Hempstead. Annette Hempstead seems to have been a VP or something with, was it Mattel? Some toy company. Branched out, did her own thing, created a line of dolls, and these are really lifelike dolls. Now, my wife, Rhonda, wasn't so much into dolls as she was sewing dresses. And these dolls had a unique trait. They're tall enough to be lifelike little girls. And so they provided the perfect model for dresses, little dresses. And so Rhonda invested in one of these dolls, and then another, and then another. And well, now we're just, you know, it's like a bad horror movie. It's like Chucky. We got way too many dolls around. But before long, she had customers who wanted a custom-made doll dress for their dolls. Now, these are not inexpensive dolls. These are collector dolls. And the collectors of these dolls, guess who they are like? They're just like car guys. They want to customize. They're just like hi-fi and audiophile guys. They want to tweak. They don't want to look like everybody else. They don't want to have what everybody else has. They want something special. And thus was born her doll dress business. You know, but the business model is terrible. Now, she loves to sew. It's not about making big money. It's about enjoying the craft and the art of making a dress. She enjoys that. And no business model is going to stop that, because that's the whole point of her enterprise. It's a means of affording her the opportunity to do what she most loves to do. So, now it doesn't scale very well. But you know, it doesn't have to. Now, she could employ a room full of seamstresses, and they could crank out dozens of dresses a day. Okay, well, then she'd be spending her days doing work that she hates, managing a group of seamstresses. She wouldn't be doing the work she loves. Other people would be paid a lesser amount to do the very thing that she most loves to do. So, and there's the practical reality that the demand for custom doll dresses, it won't likely support such an enterprise anyway. I mean, come on, it's a narrow, narrow market. And so over time, her prices have increased. I would suspect her prices have more than doubled since she started, maybe tripled. She does terrific work, and she spends hours and hours and hours on a single dress. It's what she does. It's what she wants to do. Most of her dresses, they're one of a kind, which is exactly what she wants. And guess what? That's exactly what her customers want. In fact, some of the dresses, they are commissioned by clients all over the world who tell her the kind of dress they want. And if you calculate what she earns by the hour, okay, it still doesn't make much business sense until you account for the pleasure she gets from it, well, then it becomes priceless. Now, I'm in a similar boat, kind of, sort of, except I need more money, and I want more money. I'm wired for deep connection. I think it was episode 4030 where I talked about being the 1%. If you are into Myers-Briggs, I am an INFJ. And part of that means I'm a guy who prefers fewer connections, but I want deeper connections. I want to really get to know people. I'm much less interested in just having a bevy of, you know, of people in my circle that I know very little about. I would rather have fewer people that I know as much about as they're willing to share. I'm comfortable getting up in front of larger crowds and speaking, but I'd hate to make that my life's work. And the reason I'd hate to make it my life's work is it's just too one way for me. And I'm not all that drawn, in spite of the fact that I have a podcast or two, I'm not that drawn to just being out front. I want to get to know people. I want to make a personal connection. I want to get to know what's bothering people and to see if there's anything I can do to help people. It's just how I'm wired. I am not a one size fits all kind of guy. I hate platitudes and I hate trite drivel and guruism. Well, that wouldn't suit me even if I wanted it. I'd rather be in a room, just you and me, trying to help you figure out a better way. I'd rather be focused on you than for us to talk about me. And over time, that gives me the opportunity to be indispensable. It's my big value proposition. But I'm not trying to be your career or enterprise cocaine. I'm not working to make sure that you get hooked on me. And that sucks for me. But it's great for you, which is precisely why I do it. Now, my business model is terrific in two ways. I believe there are two basic ways to be unique in the market. And by the way, I think this is also true at work when it comes to your career. And it doesn't matter what your career is. It'll work no matter if you're a scientist working in a lab. It doesn't matter if you're a sales rep on the road. It doesn't matter if you're a trucker making a cross-country delivery. This strategy of uniqueness works because it's based solely on delivering value. It's only about delivering value. Yes, value is in the eye of the beholder. But how? Well, that's where my business model works terrifically well. I provide value to my clients by, first of all, doing things others can't, and secondly, by doing things others won't. Okay, does that mean nobody else can serve my clients with value? No, of course not. But it does mean that nobody can provide the value that I do. Nobody else has my background, my experience, my perspective, my philosophy, or my approach. And I can promise you that nobody will invest more time and effort into the process. I mean, quite simply, I do whatever it takes to move my clients forward, and I guarantee their happiness. It's a competitive advantage that I don't bark loudly enough about, but yeah, okay, that's another story for another day. Listen, I love sitting down with a client, diving into their world, figuring out solutions to their problems, and helping them explore better ways to do things. And the personal connection is what I love most. You know, it's a little bit like being a dog lover. I am a dog lover, and I've had dogs, and I've lost dogs. Dogs don't live forever. Right now I have a brother and sister, West Highland Terriers. They are 15 years old, well, almost. And you fall in love with these critters, and you get used to having them around, and you enjoy being with them. Now, Rocky and Rosie are my current dogs of choice, and Rocky and Rosie are both a little hard of hearing, having a real hard time seeing, but otherwise they're very healthy, especially for 15-year-old dogs. Yeah, they move a little slower, and they sleep a whole lot more, but they're healthy. And when you are a dog lover and you enjoy being with them and you enjoy having them around, it makes it really hard on you when they're no longer around. And when my work comes to an end with a client, it's like suffering that kind of a loss. because I've grown close to these people. I've become acquainted with their team. I've become acquainted with their enterprise. I know their business. I know their organization well. My get it factor is high going in, but you know, over time, the more time you spend with these people, well, the get it factor just soars. And so time spent explaining who people are and just other daily situations, it's not necessary because I already get it. I already know the lay of the land. I know these things because of the depth of my work. And so you can understand that when it ends, I fall into a funk for a day or two. Now, it also gives me a competitive advantage in that you don't have to, there's no time spent getting me ramped up to speed. I'm there. And it's not much different really for me than having a child move out after they've grown up. And I've experienced that too as a father of grown kids. And we want our kids to grow up, but we're sad when it happens. Scale never much mattered to me. Now, I know people, they love to think about growing scale, right? Bigger is always better. I don't know, not necessarily. Rhonda still wants to sew. I still want to coach and help people. We happen to be people who are attracted to the work. And the work for us is personal. It's not so much about scale. Oh, certainly. Does she want to provide custom doll dresses for as many people as she can? Sure. Do I want to coach and help as many people as I can? Yes. She doesn't want to do it to the exclusion of giving up sewing, and I don't want to do it to the exclusion of diving deeper with clients. Now, don't give this, don't trade time for money crapola. I'm sorry. I don't buy it. We're all trading time for money at some level. The key is to trade it on terms that ideally suit us if we can. Now, not everybody can do that. And in that case, trade as little time for as much money as you can, right? And be happy. I mean, what's wrong with that? I don't think there's anything wrong with that. The workplace is full of people doing honest, good work who have no desire to be self-employed. I mean, I get that entrepreneurship, you know, there's so many podcasts that are just, it's just nauseating to me, all the entrepreneurship stuff. And, you know, you go to podcasting conventions, so-called, and it's really not about podcasting. It's about making money. It's a business opportunity kind of a play. I don't know. I'm a business guy and been in business all my life, but I don't know. It's not why I'm there. It's not why I would go. And so anymore, I don't go. The workplace is full of people that they don't want to be self-employed. I know a lot of people who are employed gainfully and they love what they do and they love where they do it. And frankly, they couldn't do it if they hung their own shingle out. I commonly refer to these coaches, particularly these elite coaches in, you know, Division I football, college football, or the NFL. There are so many opportunities. And if a guy's really driven to coach, well, okay, you could say in one level you're kind of self-employed because the gigs tend to change, but you do need to be hired. I know Seth Godin can say we don't live in a permission-based society, but he's wrong. He's wrong. If you want to be a football coach, somebody's got to hire you. Somebody's got to give you the opportunity. And you can do in that organization what you can't do, hanging your own shingle out. So, you know, if you're not so disposed, don't get your head all wrapped around the axle of entrepreneurship. Small business ownership. Listen, it's things aren't always as sexy as they look. And not everybody out there who's shouting from the rooftops that it's the end all be all. Many of them are, well, they're practicing deceit like Walter White. You really think that a person who is working in a workplace, you really think they have no way of being happy in their work? Now, come on. That's naive. That's naive. Because it could be. It just could be that we all get what we deserve. I don't know that we always get what we deserve, but maybe we mostly do. So I think the key is whether you work for yourself or whether it's just a career that you're trying to figure out a better model for. It's worthwhile to think about it. It's worthwhile to sketch some things out and think about some better ways that we can be more valuable. And that really is what a business model is about. You've got to provide value in the marketplace. You've got to provide value at work. And if you don't do that, well, then you're in trouble. My business model is intentionally bad in the sense that I don't want to scale it, in the sense that I'm not terribly interested in serving people in a hands-off way, in some distant fashion. I love technology, and I think that we can all use technology to our benefit. But it still is about the relationship for me. It still is about the connection. And that's good for me. You're listening to Bad Finger. This was the final song that was played on the very last episode of Breaking Bad. It's from their Straight Up album. I remember buying this album in 1972. The song is Baby Blue. It's a great song. They were kind of a Beatles startup kit. They had enough fame, but this was by far and away their most popular song, I think. LeaningTowardWisdom.com, that's the website. My name is Randy Cantrell. I'd love it if you'd join the Facebook group. There's a link over the website where you can do that. Again, you can find the show notes at LeaningTowardWisdom.com. Just find episode 4051. Coming to you from Dallas, Fort Worth, Texas, inside the Yellow Studio, I wish you well. Let's stick with the color blue, shall we? Since we started out with Crystal Blue Persuasion by Tommy James and we ended with Badfinger's Baby Blue, both taken from the Breaking Bad television show, that's where most people know them. Obviously, those tunes came out way before that. Tommy James in 1969, Badfinger in 1972. Let's go back. I don't know what record this was originally on. I purchased it on a 2000 record called 20 Golden Hits. The artist is Roy Orbison, and the song is Blue Bayou.
I feel so bad, I've got a worried mind. I'm so lonesome all the time. Since I left my baby behind on Blue Bayou. Saving nickels, saving dimes, working till the sun don't shine. Looking forward to happier times on Blue Bayou. I'm going back someday. See my baby again, and to be with some of my friends. Maybe I'd be happy then on Blue Bayou. I'm going back someday, gonna stay on Blue Bayou. I'll never be blue. My dreams come true.